his farm and crossed state lines, it lay beyond Congress's commerce power. The Supreme Court disagreed and upheld the law. Building on earlier decisions like Jones and Lachlan Steele, the court emphasized the cumulative effects home-consumed wheat would have on the national agricultural economy. While the amount of excess wheat any individual farmer may consume on his own farm may be minuscule, the aggregate of homegrown and home-consumed wheat could be substantial. If Filburn didn't use his own wheat, he would have to buy wheat on the market to feed his animals and family. His failure to purchase wheat on the market, therefore, impacted the national price for wheat. And while Filburn's own impact on the market wheat price might be tiny, the collective impact of all the farmers who grew excess wheat could be significant. As Justice Robert Jackson put it, the court would look at Filburn's behavior taken together with that of many others similarly situated. Wickard thus introduced into Commerce Clause jurisprudence the concept of aggregation. To determine whether an activity has substantial effects on interstate commerce, the court would not look at the isolated activity of the particular party in the particular case. Rather, the court would aggregate the effects of all similar activity to see if the activity cumulatively had substantial effects on interstate commerce. If it did, then Congress could regulate such activity using its commerce power. From one perspective, the court's reasoning makes sense. If lots of farmers acted as Filburn had, they collectively would affect the price of wheat nationally. Congress's ability to address national economic problems and to try to protect farmers from low commodity prices would be severely hampered if it could not aggregate individual behavior. From another perspective, though, the Wickard case signaled yet another expansion of congressional power. Filburn's consumption of wheat grown on his own farm didn't seem to involve commerce, much less interstate commerce at all. Filburn hadn't bought or sold anything. He hadn't even left his own farm. Critics worried that if Congress could tell Filburn he couldn't eat his own homegrown wheat, then it could do anything. The Supreme Court's broader interpretation of the Commerce Clause has had significant and long-lasting effects on our system of government. The size and reach of the federal government grew tremendously during the 20th century, in large part thanks to the New Deal transformation. Today, the United States Code is full of laws justified under Congress's commerce power. Was this transformation justified in itself? Both its critics and supporters have legitimate arguments. The critics are correct that federal power today exceeds anything the framers envisioned. I think it's safe to say the framers would be astonished by the modern federal government's regulatory reach. But the supporters also have a point that Congress's commerce power has not grown in isolation, but rather in response to economic changes that have made our nation's many communities far more interconnected than they were in the 18th century. Much commerce in 1788 truly was local. People made things and sold things within their communities, and many goods never crossed state lines. Many people never crossed state lines. The country today is very different, and many transactions that occur within one state's borders have effects that can be felt across the whole nation. The transformation's legitimacy, then, may depend on which arguments you emphasize. Let me ask a more theoretical question. Without changing a word of the Constitution, the 1937 switch radically transformed its effect. What brings about such transformation? And what, if anything, makes it legitimate? One answer, for better or worse, is that constitutional transformation occurs whenever five justices on the Supreme Court believe that change is warranted. While that narrative has some truth, it's not the whole story. The 1937 switch is not simply a case of changed judicial interpretation. As the Yale law scholar Bruce Ackerman has pointed out, the nation was engaged in a great constitutional debate throughout the 1930s. President Roosevelt argued repeatedly that the Constitution granted the federal government the power to confront serious national problems like the Great Depression. Congressional Democrats made similar constitutional arguments, and along with Roosevelt, they won election after election. Viewed through this lens, popular opinion about what the Constitution should mean might have a real influence on judicial interpretation. FDR himself seemed to make that point when he argued that the Constitution was a layman's document, not a lawyer's contract. Of course, some argue that the Constitution's meaning should not change in response to popular opinion. But one of the lessons of 1937 appears to be that public opinion, for better or worse, can reshape the court's attitudes, and with it, the law of the land. This is a complex and fascinating issue we'll explore more deeply in future lectures. It's also worth noting that multiple important constitutional doctrines sometimes change simultaneously. I focus today on the expansion of national power, but the 1937 switch in time also brought along a second and related constitutional change that protected state economic regulation from judicial interference. We'll dive into this related change in a future lecture as well. Finally, we could also see the transformation as a story about judicial modesty. In the eyes of Roosevelt's Supreme Court appointees, the pre-1937 court had not given sufficient respect to elected officials. In some cases, a bare majority of five justices had struck down important governmental programs that had been passed by elected members of Congress and signed by a popular president to deal with pressing problems. To new justices like Felix Frankfurter, the court should not supplant the wisdom of the political branches with its own ideological preferences. In the view of these justices, the switch in time was right, not really because it expanded Congress's powers, but because it limited the powers of the court. So was the court's famous switch the correct constitutional interpretation? There's no single right answer to this question. The text of the Constitution doesn't answer it clearly one way or another, nor does history. What we can say is that constitutional interpretation matters enormously, and that differing interpretations will continue to reshape our government and our relationship with it. To illustrate this point, we'll look at how the Commerce Clause has been interpreted since the New Deal in our next lecture.
The legal information provided in these lectures is for informational purposes only and not for the purpose of providing legal advice. You should contact an attorney to obtain advice with respect to any particular legal issue or problem. Lecture 5. Congress and the Commerce Clause Today.
During the New Deal era, as we have seen, the Supreme Court reinterpreted the Commerce Clause of Article 1, Section 8 to increase Congress's power substantially. The court then expanded that power still further in 1942 in Wickard v. Filburn. The country thus entered the period after World War II with a newly strengthened federal government. As the nation's population and economy grew, Congress began to use its power to address a variety of pressing societal issues, and the court faced the question of just how far the Commerce Clause would allow Congress's power to reach. One of the most famous examples is in the area of civil rights. As you may know, the United States remained a very racially segregated society well into the second half of the 20th century. In many parts of the country, African Americans faced terrible discrimination, and in some places, especially the Deep South, segregation was the official policy of state and local governments. We're going to look at the problem of racial segregation through the lens of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause in a later lecture, covering, among other things, the court's famous 1954 decision in Brown v. Board of Education, which held racially segregated public schools unconstitutional. But the problem of segregation is relevant to our continuing exploration of the Commerce Clause because the court's rulings in Brown and other important equal protection cases actually changed little for African Americans on the ground for many years. It was to address this situation that a full decade after Brown, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it was the Commerce Clause that the government used to justify many parts of that statute. You may well ask why. A statute about civil rights certainly seems like it has more to do with concepts like equal protection and basic fairness than with the sort of economic matters that would seem to be at the core of the Commerce Clause. A more plausible constitutional provision to justify the Civil Rights Act might therefore be Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, which empowers Congress to pass laws enforcing the substantive provisions of the 14th Amendment, including the Equal Protection Clause. When Congress sees violations of the 14th Amendment, it can legislate under Section 5 to try to prevent or remedy those violations. The problem with using Section 5 to support the Civil Rights Act, however, was that some important 19th century precedent had construed that section narrowly. Specifically, in an 1883 case called the Civil Rights Cases, the court had held that Congress can only legislate under Section 5 to address governmental violations of rights. But segregation was not just a product of governmental decision. To be sure, there was state-sponsored segregation, and Congress pretty clearly could use Section 5 to pass a law addressing that. But many private white businesses also practice segregation, denying African Americans a wide range of services at businesses such as restaurants, theaters, and hotels. Many provisions of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 dealt with this private racism and exclusion. The lawyers at the Department of Justice defending the constitutionality of the new Civil Rights Act therefore faced a dilemma. These provisions of the Civil Rights Act sounded like laws dealing with rights, the kind of law that would fit under Congress's Section 5 powers. But if the court was going to uphold the Civil Rights Act on Section 5 grounds, it would have to first disrupt case law nearly a century old. It's always risky to bet a case on a legal theory that would require the court to overturn precedent, especially precedent of such long standing. The lawyers therefore turned to Congress's commerce power, which they knew under existing case law was broad. The challenge was to persuade the court that the Civil Rights Act implicated commerce at all. The most famous case here is Heart of Atlanta Motel v. United States. One provision of the Civil Rights Act prohibited discrimination on the grounds of race in certain places of public accommodation. In other words, the statute forbade certain privately owned businesses, like hotels and restaurants, from refusing service on the basis of race. To most of us today, this principle seems to embody basic decency in a civilized society. But in the mid-1960s, many businesses still refused to serve African Americans. The key question in the Heart of Atlanta case was whether Congress's law, which prohibited hotels and motels from denying service on the basis of race, was a constitutional exercise of Congress's commerce power. The motel contended that it served local clientele and that it was therefore beyond the reach of federal authority. The court disagreed. In an era of the automobile, people were increasingly mobile and traveled from state to state. Racial discrimination in places of public accommodation, the court found, discouraged African Americans from traveling. It's exceedingly difficult to travel away from home if hotels and motels won't serve you. Responding to the motel's contention that its discrimination would not affect interstate commerce, the court drew on Wickard v. Filburn, which we previously discussed. The court said that motels and hotels' practices of discrimination collectively affected interstate commerce by discouraging African Americans all around the nation from traveling. Thus, as in Wickard, the court looked not just at the effects on interstate commerce of the regulated party in this case, but rather at the aggregate effects on interstate commerce from all similarly situated parties. In other words, the court didn't only ask if the Heart of Atlanta Motels policy affected interstate commerce. It asked whether similar racially discriminatory practices from countless hotels across the nation did. A companion case called Katzenbach v. McClung involved Ollie's Barbecue, a Birmingham, Alabama restaurant that served white people at tables in the restaurant but required its black customers to use a takeout window. Though the restaurant contended that it was a small local business serving only local clientele, the court followed its own reasoning from the Heart of Atlanta case. Discrimination in restaurants, like motels, has a direct and highly restrictive effect upon interstate travel by African Americans, the court said. At quick glance, the Ollie's Barbecue case might have seemed harder than the Heart of Atlanta case. After all, some restaurants really do serve primarily or even exclusively local clientele, whereas most hotels serve at least some out-of-town folks. The connection to interstate commerce, therefore, wasn't quite as obvious for Ollie's Barbecue restaurant as it was for the Heart of Atlanta motel. But in both cases, the aggregate effect of the racial discrimination severely impacted African Americans' ability to travel, which in turn had a substantial impact on interstate commerce. Moreover, as the court noted, much of the food served at Ollie's Barbecue originated from out of state, thus further implicating interstate commerce. In upholding the relevant provisions of the Civil Rights Act under the Commerce Clause, the Supreme Court indicated that it would review Congress's exercise of its commerce authority very deferentially. In the Ollie's Barbecue case, for instance, the court said that Congress had a rational basis for finding that racial discrimination in restaurants had a direct and adverse effect on the free flow of commerce. In requiring that Congress only need to have a rational basis to connect racial discrimination to interstate commerce, the court signaled that Congress doesn't need tons of evidence on the connection to interstate commerce. So long as it's not irrational for Congress to think there is such a connection, the court's going to uphold the statute. Most people today find segregation and racial discrimination abhorrent, but some critics question whether the court was correct in upholding these provisions of the Civil Rights Act under the commerce power. After all, we all know that Congress's primary motive behind the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was not really economic, but moral. The court, however, signaled strongly in Heart of Atlanta Motel and Katzenbach v. McClung that Congress's motives don't really matter so much, so long as Congress regulated activity that had a substantial impact on interstate commerce, Congress could invoke its Commerce Clause authority, even if its primary reason for acting had little to nothing to do with commerce. After these cases, it appeared that Congress had almost unlimited power to legislate under the Commerce Clause, and critics complained that Congress acted as though it could do anything. In more recent years, however, the court has cut back somewhat on this power. For instance, in 1995, the Supreme Court in United States v. Lopez struck down the Gun-Free School Zones Act of 1990 as beyond Congress's commerce authority. Mr. Lopez had been charged with violating a federal law prohibiting the possession of guns in school zones. The court struck down the law as unconstitutional. This was the first time since 1936 that the Supreme Court had found a federal law to exceed Congress's commerce power. The case was historic in that regard, and it also highlighted the divide between the conservative and liberal justices on questions of federal power. To the five conservative members of the court, led by Chief Justice William Rehnquist, the notion that Congress could prohibit guns in school zones demonstrated that federal power was frighteningly untethered to its origins. Guns in school zones may be a problem, but it was not one that had a substantial effect on interstate commerce. The government, drawing again on Wickard, had contended that guns in school zones had an aggregate and adverse effect on education, which in turn impacted the nation's economy for the worse. The majority rejected this line of constitutional argument. For one, the court emphasized that Congress should only be permitted to aggregate a phenomenon's effects if that phenomenon is economic to begin with. In Wickard, the consumption of wheat was considered economic, insofar as it involved the market for a commodity that's bought and sold. But the possession of guns in school zones is not an economic activity. Accordingly, it couldn't be aggregated. The court also emphasized that guns in school zones involved crime and education, two matters typically left to state and local governments. States and localities could ban guns in school zones if they wanted to, and many did, but this was their job, not Congress's. The four liberal dissenters, led by Justice Stephen Breyer, disagreed. For one, Breyer pointed out that the court's approach broke from over a half century of established constitutional doctrine. For better or worse, the court had interpreted the Commerce Clause to give Congress broad powers ever since 1937. The majority's approach was inconsistent with several decades of legal precedent and with Congress's expectations. Moreover, argued Justice Breyer, Congress had good reason to think that guns in school zones did substantially affect interstate commerce. Gun-related violence in and around schools negatively impacts learning, which in turn has adverse long-term effects on the economy and interstate commerce. Interestingly, although the majority did not dispute this reasoning directly, it seemed to say that the connection between guns in school zones and the economy was just too attenuated to justify congressional regulation under the commerce power. In other words, the majority indicated that there were just too many links in the chain between guns in school zones and interstate commerce for there really to be an interstate commerce issue. Lopez was an important case in signaling that the court would place some limits on congressional power, but it was not yet clear exactly how important. Prior to Lopez, Congress had gotten sloppy and had more or less assumed it could do what it wanted. The court in Lopez pointed out several flaws in the gun statute that collectively undermined its constitutionality. Congress, for instance, had failed to include findings detailing the connection between guns in school zones and interstate commerce. Congress had also failed to include in the statute what the court referred to as a jurisdictional element, requiring that the prosecution prove that the gun in the school zone had actually traveled in interstate commerce. Such flaws, however, can be easily remedied in future statutes. Indeed, Congress later revised the Gun-Free School Zone Act to include such a jurisdictional element. A lower court upheld the constitutionality of this new statute, and the Supreme Court declined to review the case. From this perspective, one could perhaps see Lopez as a case about congressional drafting errors. That is, as a case in which the court signaled to Congress that it must dot its I's and cross its T's, rather than a significant restriction on Congress's commerce power. In spite of its limited practical effects, however, Lopez nevertheless signaled what some scholars have called the Rehnquist Federalism Revolution. President Ronald Reagan elevated Rehnquist from the position of Associate Justice to the Chief Justice in 1986, at the same time he appointed Justice Antonin Scalia to the court. Chief Justice Warren Burger had retired, so Rehnquist replaced Burger as the chief, and Scalia replaced Rehnquist as the associate justice. Rehnquist and Scalia, along with Justices Sandra Day O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy, and Clarence Thomas, all felt that federal power had grown too expansive. The appointment of these justices was no accident. Between 1969 and 1993, Republicans controlled the White House for 20 of 24 years. During that period, Republican presidents appointed 10 consecutive justices to the high court. Jimmy Carter, the only Democratic president during that period, did not get a single Supreme Court appointment because no sitting justice retired or died during Carter's presidency. Now, to be sure, some of these Republican appointees, like Justices John Paul Stevens and David Souter, often voted in important cases with more liberal members of the court. But Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justices O'Connor, Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas all believed strongly that the federal government should have less power and that the state government should have more. To this extent, the Lopez decision reflected the success of the Republican Party in national presidential elections and the importance of those elections on the future of the judiciary and the law. The same quintet of justices who had comprised the Lopez majority made clear that that case had not been an anomaly a few years later when it offered similar reasoning in striking down a provision of the Violence Against Women Act of 1994 in a case called United States v. Morrison. Congress had included a civil damages provision in the statute, permitting women who were the victims of gender-motivated violence to sue their assaulters under federal law to recover compensatory and punitive damages. Drawing on its earlier decision in Lopez, the court struck down the provision, again indicating that these kind of matters ought to be left to state governments. Interestingly, whereas Congress had neglected to include findings in the Gun-Free School Zone Act linking the activity, guns in school zones, to interstate commerce, in the Violence Against Women Act, Congress had included extensive findings. Gender-motivated violence, Congress found, had a serious impact on victims and their families, deterring victims from traveling interstate, from engaging in employment in interstate business, and from transacting business. Collectively, these effects diminished national productivity and impacted interstate commerce. Though the court in Lopez had faulted Congress for failing to include findings in that statute, the majority justices in Morrison brushed aside Congress's findings in the Violence Against Women Act. Congressional findings, the court seemed to say, were necessary but not sufficient to sustain the constitutionality of legislation under the Commerce Clause. And the court refused to uphold this statute, reasoning that if Congress could do this, it could regulate any crime based on the nationwide aggregate impact of that crime on interstate commerce. Violence against women may have an economic impact, but like the possession of guns in school zones, it's not itself economic activity. Therefore, Congress could not take the cumulative economic effect of such activity to assert authority under the Commerce Clause. Lopez and Morrison were both deeply divided 5-4 decisions. The justices' votes, moreover, were predictable, with the more conservative justices lining up in the majority and the more liberal justices in dissent. Though the opinions focused on finer points of constitutional doctrine, the disagreement was at bottom one about different conceptions of the Constitution's divisions of federal and state power. To a large extent, these disagreements reflected broader rifts in our national politics. The justices' opinions in these cases addressed legal, not political questions, but it's important to remember that these legal questions do not exist in a vacuum, but rather are closely tethered to different political visions. This inevitable connection between law and politics became readily apparent in 2012, when the court confronted yet another Commerce Clause question, this time one that attracted the attention of the entire nation. In 2010, Congress passed the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act to address what it perceived to be serious problems with the nation's healthcare system. Also known as Obamacare, because President Barack Obama had championed healthcare reform and signed the bill into law, the Affordable Care Act, or ACA for short, was a tremendously significant and controversial piece of legislation. When a constitutional challenge to some of its provisions reached the Supreme Court in a case called National Federation of Independent Businesses v. Sebelius, NFIB v. Sebelius for short, the country realized the High Court's decision would have not only important legal implications, but also enormous political and policy implications as well. The Affordable Care Act was a massive, complicated statute, but the Commerce Clause challenge involved a particular provision of it known as the individual mandate. Here's how it worked. One of Congress's main goals in the ACA was to increase the number of Americans with health insurance and to decrease the cost of health care. The individual mandate required most Americans to maintain minimal health insurance. Most people who failed to have health insurance would be subject to pay a penalty when they filed their taxes. One of the government's legal theories was that the individual mandate was a constitutional exercise of Congress's commerce power. The rationale for it, the government explained, was that the healthcare market is characterized by a cost-shifting problem. Nearly everyone will need healthcare at some point, but many people cannot predict when they will need it. People without health insurance sometimes require healthcare unexpectedly. For instance, people can get into a serious accident or can be suddenly stricken by serious disease. Because doctors and hospitals are expensive, people without health insurance often cannot afford to pay for their health care when they need it. Federal and state laws usually require hospitals to provide services to everyone, regardless of ability to pay, Many hospitals would do this anyway because of professional or religious norms. As a result, when people without health insurance require medical care, they often go to hospital emergency rooms, get treatment, and don't pay. Hospitals, of course, lose money when they treat people who don't pay for their services. To recoup these losses, hospitals charge more to everyone else. This means that insurance companies need to pay more to reimburse hospitals for people who are covered by insurance, which in turn means that health insurance premiums are higher for everybody. One way health insurance companies can manage their costs and keep prices down is to refuse to sell health insurance to people who are already sick, or to charge them more for insurance. Sick people are expensive to insure because they usually need medical attention immediately and or often, but many sick people without health insurance go to the hospital anyway and just don't pay. As I just explained, this ends up raising healthcare costs for everyone. To deal with this cost-shifting problem, Congress included a provision in the ACA that prohibited insurance companies from denying health insurance coverage to sick people and from charging sick people more than healthy people. Such a provision, Congress reasoned, would help more people have health insurance, which in turn would mean that we have fewer free riders, that is, fewer uninsured people who go to hospitals without paying their bills. These provisions, however, created another problem, which is that some people may wait to purchase health insurance until they get sick. After all, if a healthy person knows she can still buy health insurance when she gets sick, she might as well save money by waiting to buy insurance later when she actually needs it. This phenomenon is what economists call adverse selection, and it too results in higher insurance prices for everyone else. Insurance works when the pool is broad, so that the premiums paid by healthy people, who don't need much health care, are in effect subsidizing care for the sick, who need lots of health care. But if people can wait till they are sick to buy insurance, then there will be no incentive for healthy people to buy insurance, which means that the pool will include too many sick people and not enough healthy people, which means that the insurance companies will need to charge everybody a lot more. To deal with this problem and the problem of uninsured people going to emergency rooms without paying for their care, Congress included the individual mandate, requiring almost all individuals to have health insurance. The government's theory was that Congress had the constitutional authority to pass this individual mandate because an individual's failure to purchase health insurance negatively affected interstate commerce by creating this cost-shifting problem. Five justices on the Supreme Court rejected this argument. As Chief Justice John Roberts explained it, Congress was not regulating commerce so much as compelling individuals not engaged in commerce to purchase an unwanted product. In other words, Congress was forcing people to buy something they didn't want, and then saying it could regulate that purchase because it was commerce. According to the Chief Justice, however, the commerce didn't exist until Congress forced people to buy the insurance. In fact, the individuals weren't doing anything before Congress forced them to buy insurance. The Commerce Clause, the Chief Justice contended, does not allow Congress to regulate inactivity in this way. Four justices disagreed sharply with this characterization. Led by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, these justices argued that Congress was in fact regulating commerce. The healthcare market, she explained, is characterized by this unique free rider problem. It's inaccurate to describe uninsured persons as entirely inactive. Rather, those people are making the decision to pass on their healthcare costs to everyone else. Of course, in a given year, some people without health insurance won't see a doctor, but many will, and nearly all persons will receive healthcare at some point in their lives, whether they want it or not. For this reason, these people are active in the healthcare market. Moreover, Congress reasonably concluded that uninsured persons' consumption of healthcare drives up costs for everyone else, thereby impacting interstate commerce. As you can probably see, a big part of the disagreement between Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Ginsburg in the NFIB case boiled down to questions of characterization. The chief characterized the uninsured person as inactive and therefore outside the stream of commerce. Accordingly, Congress couldn't say it was regulating commerce when it forced that person to buy health insurance. By contrast, Justice Ginsburg characterized the person as a free rider who would inevitably consume health care eventually, perhaps tomorrow, perhaps next month, perhaps next year. Because that free rider drove costs up for everyone else, his decision necessarily had a serious impact on interstate commerce. Accordingly, Congress, according to Justice Ginsburg, could regulate under the Commerce Clause. The NFIB case, along with Lopez and Morrison, are important reminders that congressional power is not unlimited. But the extent of these limitations remains unclear. The Affordable Care Act, for instance, is an unusual statute. Most laws don't require individuals to buy something. So even though it was notable that the court found the individual mandate to go beyond Congress's commerce power, it's not clear that its reasoning will have implications in other cases. It's also important to note that even though the court found that the mandate was not supported by the Commerce Clause, it ultimately upheld the individual mandate as a proper exercise of Congress's taxing power. As a result, even though five justices rejected the individual mandate on Commerce Clause grounds, the provision remained good law because it was justified under a different congressional power. For that reason, too, then, it's unclear that NFIB's treatment of the Commerce Clause will carry much or any precedential weight in future cases. As a final note about this case, in 2017, Congress repealed the individual mandate tax. That repeal doesn't really affect the precedential value of the NFIB case, but of course it does affect the way the Affordable Care Act functions. As we've seen in this lecture and the previous one, the court's conception of Congress's commerce power and of the national government's power more generally has changed significantly over time. It has moved from relatively broad in 1824 in Gibbons v. Ogden to very narrow in the late 19th and early 20th century to very broad from 1937 to 1995 to somewhat less broad. This is not a finished story. It continues to be written, and there will undoubtedly be more chapters in the decades to come. The justices' disagreement over the question of federal power helps highlight the extent to which core constitutional questions remain unsettled, even after all these years. On the one hand, this seems surprising. You would think that after well over two centuries, we would have figured out what the federal government is and is not permitted to do. On the other hand, it's not surprising because these questions have divided us from the very start of our nation's history. Many members of the founding generation disagreed with one another about the proper scope of national power, just as we disagree with each other today. Indeed, the founders didn't just disagree with one another about such matters. Sometimes key founders, like James Madison, changed their minds over and over again during the course of their lifetimes. The nation continues to struggle over these issues because they're hard. It's not often easy to strike the proper balance between federal and state power. A particular balance that might seem right in one case or even many cases may seem wrong in a different context. For this reason, it seems likely that new generations of Americans will continue to grapple with these fundamental principles in the context of new societal challenges, and that judges' understandings of these constitutional issues will continue to change.
The legal information provided in these lectures is for informational purposes only and not for the purpose of providing legal advice. You should contact an attorney to obtain advice with respect to any particular legal issue or problem. Lecture 6, Individual Liberty, Contracts and Privacy.
Individual liberty is one of the most doctrinally and culturally controversial topics in all of constitutional law. American citizens are used to thinking of the United States as the land of liberty, but the original Constitution of 1787 contained very few rights protections. It did prohibit Congress and the states from enacting bills of attainder, that is, laws that single out one person for punishment. It prohibited them from enacting ex post facto laws, criminal statutes which make conduct illegal after the fact. It also prohibited Congress, except in cases of rebellion or invasion, from suspending habeas corpus, which allows prisoners to challenge the legality of their detention, and it prohibited states from impairing the obligations of contracts. But that short list is it. Of course, we also know that in 1791, the states ratified the Bill of Rights containing the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. These amendments contained several important rights, including freedom of speech and of the press, free exercise of religion, the right to bear arms, protections against unwarranted searches and seizures, due process protections, protections against cruel and unusual punishment, and much more. A good amount of constitutional litigation involves provisions from these amendments. Interestingly, the Bill of Rights initially applied only against the federal government, not the state governments. Many states had bills of rights in their own state constitutions that applied against that state's government. But as we'll see, most of the provisions of the U.S. Constitution's Bill of Rights did not apply against the states until the mid-20th century. More than seven decades after the Bill of Rights, in the aftermath of the Union's victory over the Confederacy in the Civil War, the states ratified three more amendments, adding important rights to the Constitution and instituting a new legal order in the country. The 13th Amendment, ratified in 1865, abolished slavery. The 15th Amendment, ratified in 1870, stipulated that the right to vote shall not be abridged for U.S. citizens on account of race or former condition as a slave. In between those two amendments came the 14th Amendment, ratified in 1868. The 14th Amendment is just as important as the 13th and 15th, but quite a bit more complicated. The 14th Amendment contains five sections. At the time it was written, much debate focused on sections 2, 3, and 4, which dealt with issues left unresolved by the end of the Civil War, such as black suffrage, former Confederates' political rights, and Union and Confederate debt. Section 5 empowers Congress to enforce the other sections. Though Congress spent significant time debating sections 2, 3, and 4, it is Section 1 that draws the most attention today. It contains several important clauses. It states that all persons born or naturalized in the United States are U.S. citizens. Among other things, this provision helped ensure that the former slaves and their descendants would be U.S. citizens, thereby overruling the controversial Dred Scott decision from before the war. Another provision holds that states may not abridge the privileges or immunities of U.S. citizens. Still another provides that the states may not deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And another provision adds that states also may not deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. Section 1 of the 14th Amendment therefore contains three clauses, the Privileges or Immunities Clause, the Due Process Clause, and the Equal Protection Clause, that seem to say something about rights, that even seem to give new rights, thereby at least ostensibly adding to the rights protected elsewhere in the Constitution. Yet, as with many important parts of the Constitution, the language of the provisions isn't exactly precise. So the big question following ratification was, what do these provisions mean? The court's first big opportunity to address that question was the Slaughterhouse Cases in 1873, which involved a Louisiana law that had given one company a monopoly over slaughterhouses for 25 years. As a result of the law, all butchers had to use this one company's slaughterhouse. The butchers, who were all white, sued, contending that the law interfered with their right to pursue their profession. Their argument was that the right to pursue lawful employment in a lawful manner was one of the privileges or immunities protected by the 14th Amendment, and that the Louisiana law violated that provision. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected the butcher's challenge. The court could have done so on narrow grounds, such as by holding that Louisiana's law was a reasonable health and safety regulation, addressing the spread of diseases at slaughterhouses. Instead, Justice Miller, writing for the majority, went out of his way to construe the 14th Amendment very narrowly. For one, Miller indicated that the 14th Amendment was primarily concerned with protecting African Americans, that is, the newly freed slaves. To this extent, the amendment wasn't concerned with these white butchers' concerns. As Professor Paul Finkelman has argued, many of the amendment's framers believed it would protect numerous groups, including Chinese, Native Americans, and women, from arbitrary or discriminatory governmental action. Over time, the 14th Amendment's reach has extended more in line with this capacious understanding, but that wasn't how the court read it in 1873. Justice Miller's opinion also gutted the amendment's Privileges or Immunities Clause, relying primarily on the distinction between the privileges or immunities of United States citizenship and those of state citizenship. Justice Miller argued that the 14th Amendment only protected privileges or immunities of U.S. citizenship. The right at issue here, he found, the right to pursue one's profession, belonged to the bundle of rights one gets by virtue of one's state citizenship and was therefore beyond the contemplation of the Privileges or Immunities Clause. The court's key distinction between the privileges or immunities of federal citizenship and those of state citizenship required sketching out the contours of those bundles of rights. Justice Miller did not go into a lot of detail here, but he did list some of the privileges or immunities of federal citizenship, including the right to travel to the national capital, the right to seek redress from the national government, the right to use seaports and internal navigable waters, the right of access to the federal courts, the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus, and the right to receive the protection of the federal government on the high seas or in foreign countries. Notice Justice Miller's limited conception of the rights of national citizenship. Most of the rights he listed existed anyway, before the 14th Amendment. Some were implicit in other constitutional provisions. Others were assumed to have been rights of all Americans, even if they weren't stated anywhere in the Constitution. And still others of these rights, for instance, the right to protection of the national government on the high seas, seem beyond the capacity of state governments to infringe, raising the puzzle of why the 14th Amendment would protect against such state action. In effect, the Supreme Court in 1873 seemed to indicate that the 14th Amendment did not change the relationship between the federal and state governments, as some people at the time had claimed. As the court itself put it, the 14th Amendment should not be understood as a perpetual censor upon all legislation of the states. The decision had the effect of insulating state law from judicial interference. The irony here is that even though the court had said that the amendment existed primarily to protect the newly freed slaves, its restrictive reading of the amendment, along with other decisions from the same era, made it harder to do exactly that. The slaughterhouse cases remain the court's most important word on the 14th Amendment's Privileges or Immunities Clause, but that decision was hardly the court's last word on the 14th Amendment more generally. Even after slaughterhouse, some people believed that the 14th Amendment protected some rights that were not expressly listed in the Constitution. There are reasons why people sought to protect such rights, as we'll be discussing shortly. But because slaughterhouse essentially gutted the Privileges or Immunities Clause, lawyers and judges have instead housed such rights in a different 14th Amendment provision, the Due Process Clause. One reason that the court has never overruled slaughterhouse is that it has instead relied on the Due Process Clause to do some of the work that the Privileges or Immunities Clause might have done had slaughterhouse come out differently. The 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause has played a crucial role in individual rights in two separate ways. First, the court has relied on the Due Process Clause to apply most of the provisions of the Bill of Rights against the state governments. Recall that the Bill of Rights, as ratified in 1791, only applied to the federal government. In a series of opinions, mostly in the mid-20th century, the U.S. Supreme Court held that the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment incorporated most of the provisions of the Bill of Rights so that they applied against the state governments too. Second, the court relied on the Due Process Clause to protect other individual rights that are not expressly mentioned elsewhere in the Constitution. The clause stipulates that no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Incidentally, the Fifth Amendment contains a similar due process clause that applies to the federal government. The idea of using the Due Process Clause to protect substantive rights, as opposed to simply procedural rights, often seems odd to lawyers and non-lawyers alike. But the Supreme Court has also fashioned a doctrine known as substantive due process that uses the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause to protect unenumerated substantive rights. As you might imagine, this doctrine is extremely controversial. For one, the term substantive due process itself is somewhat oxymoronic, converting a clause that seems to deal with procedure into one that also grants substantive rights. Additionally, the doctrine permits courts to identify rights nowhere explicitly listed in the Constitution and to use them to invalidate actions taken by democratically elected governmental officials. It's one thing for a court to strike down laws because they violate rights that are expressly protected in the Constitution, such as freedom of speech. It's more controversial for a court to do so on the basis of a right that is nowhere in the Constitution's text. And significantly, decisions by the court on some of the most controversial issues of our times have relied on substantive due process, including the right to same-sex marriage and the right to abortion. We'll turn to those cases in our next lecture. But before we get there, we need to understand the roots of substantive due process doctrine and a puzzle about its legitimacy. The roots of the substantive due process doctrine can be traced back to the era of the progressive movement in the late 19th century. Progressivism was partially a backlash against the Industrial Revolution as concern began to grow about the poor and workers' rights. During this period, several states passed laws regulating conditions of industrial labor and labor relations. One law along these lines was the New York Bake Shop Act. This law prohibited the employment of bakery workers for more than 10 hours a day or 60 hours a week. Joseph Lochner owned a bakery in Utica, New York. He was convicted of violating the statute and fined for working his employees for more than the statutory maximum. The purported goal of the statute was to protect the health of the workers. Baking exposed workers to hot temperatures, flour dust, and sometimes unsanitary conditions. Mr. Lochner contended, however, that the law interfered with his liberty of contract. In its 1905 decision in Lochner v. New York, the court agreed and struck down the Bake Shop Act as unconstitutional. In so doing, the court said that the right to contract that it protected could be found in the liberty component of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, the liberty part of the phrase life, liberty, or property. The court reasoned that the right to contract was part of the liberty the clause protected. Note that in invalidating New York's law, the court did not rely on the Contracts Clause of Article 1, Section 10. That provision states that no state shall pass any law impairing the obligation of contracts. One might think that this clause would be a better fit for the court's decision, but the court has construed the Contracts Clause as only preventing state interference with existing contracts. By contrast, the substantive due process doctrine, as developed by Lochner, protects a broader conception of economic liberty, since it prevents state legislation that might also interfere with future contracts. Interestingly, the court saw the right to contract as protecting both the employer and the employee. The right to purchase or to sell labor, explained Justice Peckham, writing for the majority, is part of the liberty protected by this amendment. The court made clear that its ruling did not mean that a state can never regulate in this area. Courts, Justice Peckham explained, must always ask whether the regulation in question is fair, reasonable, or arbitrary. A genuine health statute would be a reasonable exercise of the state's inherent governmental powers. For example, the court pointed out that a few years earlier, it had upheld a statute regulating the working hours for underground mining because mining is a hazardous activity. The court did not see baking that way. In the court's eyes, then, this wasn't a health statute, but an arbitrary infringement on the right of employers and employees to make contracts with each other. The dissenting justices, of course, saw things differently. Given that labor law, union organizing, and collective bargaining were only in their infancy, the bakery employees lacked the bargaining leverage to really negotiate favorable terms. In early 20th century America, the employers usually had all the power, and employment conditions could be horrific. Accordingly, Justice Harlan, in dissent, argued that the New York legislature had thought there was a health issue that it needed to address, and that it was not the court's place to inquire into the wisdom of that judgment. The majority, he said, had second-guessed the legislature's connection between the hours a baker works and the healthfulness of the bread and the worker. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote his own dissent. He objected to the majority's decision to strike down a democratically enacted law on the basis of an economic philosophy that appears nowhere in the Constitution. The majority of the court subscribed to laissez-faire economics, free market thinking, believing that government should not interfere in the private sphere. Holmes was likely sympathetic to these economic views, but he did not think that the Constitution embraced that economic philosophy or any economic philosophy for that matter. The 14th Amendment, Holmes wrote, does not enact Mr. Herbert Spencer's social statics, referring to a popular book espousing social evolution and the survival of the fittest. Justice Holmes' views, however, did not prevail yet. By the late 1930s, however, the court disavowed Lochner's use of the Due Process Clause. In a famous 1937 case called West Coast Hotel v. Parrish, the court upheld a minimum wage law for women, even though an earlier case had struck down a virtually identical law. According to the 1937 court, the freedom of contract vindicated in cases like Lochner is nowhere to be found in the Constitution. Moreover, reasonable regulation satisfies due process, and the regulation at issue in West Coast Hotel was reasonable. Indeed, starting with West Coast Hotel, the court would employ a deferential rational basis test when reviewing economic legislation challenged on substantive due process grounds. So long as the law in question was rational, in other words, so long as it wasn't completely crazy and arbitrary, courts would uphold it. Moreover, the court started paying attention to unequal bargaining power. The West Coast Hotel Court explained that female workers were routinely exploited by avaricious business owners, and if government chose to try to protect those women, it was not the judiciary's place to undo that decision. Notice that this justification abandoned Lochner's more formalistic view of bargaining. Whereas Lochner had reasoned that employers and employees could simply bargain for labor terms, 3 decades later, many people in the country had come to realize that different parties have different degrees of bargaining leverage. As the scholar Cass Sunstein has pointed out, whereas the court in Lochner did not like the legislature meddling with the existing distribution of wealth by offering special protections to employees, the court in West Coast Hotel seemed to recognize that the law itself helps create the existing distribution of wealth. On that view, there's nothing inherently improper about a law protecting workers' rights, and the court should not undo the legislature's efforts to protect those with unequal bargaining power. Notice that the court decided West Coast Hotel in 1937. Recall from Lecture 4 that this was the same year it switched its Commerce Clause interpretation and started upholding federal New Deal legislation designed to protect workers and revive the economy. The court's move away from Lochner and from narrow constructions of the Commerce Clause then are very much connected. With West Coast Hotel's abandonment of Lochner, the concept of substantive due process, of unwritten constitutional rights materializing via the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause, seemed moribund. Nearly 3 decades later, it was revived in 1965 in a case with completely different facts. The case was Griswold v. Connecticut, and it involved a Connecticut statute criminalizing the use of contraception or a doctor's prescription of contraceptives. The statute had been enacted in 1879, but by the 1960s, it was rarely